Chapter 21. Glimpses Behind the Veil. The remote epoch between 6,000 and 5,000 years ago, out of which Lower Jackson Mound emerges, is an important one in the story of civilization. It was toward the end of this same millennium that the civilizations of ancient Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt took their first confident steps on the stage of history. They, too, built mounds, for example, Egypt's pre-dynastic mastabas or the tells of Uruk period Mesopotamia. They too deployed geometry and astronomical alignments in the project of sacralizing architectural spaces. And they too participated in an extraordinary and seemingly coordinated burst of early construction, for just like the mounds of ancient Egypt and ancient Mesopotamia, Lower Jackson Mound is not an isolated case, but part of what may once have been a very numerous and widespread group of monuments. Just how numerous and widespread we may never hope to know, because of the wholesale destruction of thousands of mounds and earthworks across North America in recent centuries. No doubt most of these ancient monuments sacrificed to the modern gods of agriculture and industry were from the more recent periods, Mississippian, Hopewell, and so on. But chances are that some, and perhaps many, were from the much earlier episode of mound building dating back to 5,000 years ago and more. From what remains, we can begin to gauge the extent of the loss, and by 2012, despite the destruction of ancient sites, archaeologists had identified as many as 97 surviving mounds and earthworks in the lower Mississippi Valley, with several others found as far afield as Florida, thought to be in the range of 5,000 years old. Very few of these sites have yet been subject to radiometric dating, but of the 16 that have, with a combined total of 53 mounds and 13 causeways, all are more than 4,700 years old, and many are much older than that. As a result, says Joe Saunders, a leading specialist in this field, the existence of Middle Archaic mound building is no longer questioned. Why there should be such a concentration of these archaic sites in the lower Mississippi Valley is unclear. It could be an accident of history. That is, purely by chance, more old sites survived destruction in this area than elsewhere. Or it could be that many more sites were built here in antiquity than elsewhere, and this is why more have survived. Who knows? Perhaps future research will reveal very ancient mounds much farther afield in North America. For the present, however, the lower Mississippi Valley is where the action is. It's unnecessary to describe every site. Indeed, only one, Watson Brake, need concern us in any detail. For the rest, the minimal listing that follows will serve the purpose. The Banana Bayou Mounds and the so-called LSU Mounds, because they are on the grounds of Louisiana State University, date to around 2700 BC, which, in a global context, makes them about 200 years older than the Great Pyramid of Giza. After that, the mounds of the lower Mississippi Valley just keep on getting older. We've already spoken of Lower Jackson Mound, 3,955 to 3,655 BC. Here are some of the others. Watson Brake. One carbon-14 date suggests that mound building may have begun as early as 3,590 BC. Others suggest a range of 3,400 to 3,300 BC. Caney Mounds. Carbon-14 dates range from 3,600 to 3,000 BC. Frenchman's Bend. Carbon-14 supports a date of 3,570 BC. A significantly older date of 4,610 BC, almost 7,000 years ago, was derived from an excavated hearth. Hedgepeth Mounds. The earliest mound date is 4,930 BC, again very close to 7,000 years ago. Montesano. A charcoal sample from a cremation platform within one of the mounds yielded a date of 4,240 BC. Two other charcoal samples from a small platform mound produced dates of 5,030 to 5,050 BC, moving past 7,000 years ago and towards 7,500 years ago. Conley. Eight radiocarbon dates securely locate the site between 7,500 and 8,000 years ago. the site that changed the game. Both in terms of quantity and of quality, Watson Break has been the subject of more thorough, sustained, and wide-ranging scientific scrutiny than any of the other sites that are 5,000 years old or older. Moreover, it's only at Watson Break that the excavations and archaeological research have been accompanied by detailed archaeoastronomical assessments, allowing comparison with the later Adena, Hopewellian, and Mississippian sites reviewed in previous chapters. So it's Watson Break we'll focus on here. First, and it's good the listener should harbor no illusions in this regard, not a single item has been excavated at Watson Break that in any way suggests the presence of an advanced material culture. The people who built the mounds and lived at the site intermittently or perhaps more permanently over a period of many hundreds of years used stone tools and points that are typical of the Middle Archaic period. They were hunter-gatherers, not agriculturalists, and although they did gather plants that would later be domesticated, they did not domesticate these plants themselves. In other words, they lived simply, close to the earth, and were in every way a normal and representative population for this part of North America 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. In every way, that is, except one. They built mounds. Referring to the sites I just listed and a handful of others I didn't, Joe Saunders writes, "The earliest earthworks in the lower Mississippi Valley appear to have been made by autonomous societies. Practically speaking, it's difficult for 16 Middle Archaic mound sites spanning 1,000 years of prehistory in 3 subregions of Louisiana not to look autonomous. But there must have been some communion among the autonomous societies because there are too many shared traits that cross the vast expanses of the lower Mississippi Valley, and there is no evidence of other monuments being made elsewhere. If all Middle Archaic mound sites were spontaneous creations, would they not occur spontaneously elsewhere as well?" Sadly, Saunders passed away on September 4, 2017. Formerly regional archaeologist and professor of geosciences at the University of Louisiana, he was the acknowledged expert on Watson Break and its lead excavator. It was his paper, A Mound Complex in Louisiana at 5,400 to 5,000 Years Before the Present, published in Science on September 19, 1997, that effectively put Watson Break on the map, preempting arguments that might otherwise have arisen around the dates of the site, with a meticulous, comprehensive, and wide-ranging body of evidence. "There's just no question about it," said John Gibson at the time. "Saunders has come at it from too many different angles." And Vinkas Stepanitis of the University of North Carolina commented, "It's rare that archaeologists ever find something that so totally changes our picture of what happened in the past, as is true for this case." Certainly, Watson Break did change the picture archaeologists had of the past, delivering the death blow to the tired old prejudice, already mortally wounded by Poverty Point, that hunter-gatherer societies were somehow constitutionally incapable of complex, large-scale constructions. And as it turns out, despite its low-maintenance material culture, the site itself is sophisticated and precociously clever. Sacred Oval. Like Serpent Mound, Watson Break was built on a natural elevation, in this case a terrace, dating back to the depths of the Ice Age, overlooking the 12,000-year-old floodplain of the Washita River, with its tributary stream, the Watson Bayou. And in just the way that Serpent Mound stands above Brush Creek, Watson Break stands above Watson Bayou, creating the illusion that the mounds are 5 or 10 meters higher than they actually are. In the case of Serpent Mound, in front of the effigy's gaping jaws, the listener will recall the presence of an earthwork enclosure in the form of a great oval. Although complicated by the integration of mounds into the figure, and on a much larger scale, Watson Break is also an earthwork enclosure, forming a distinct and unmistakable oval with a long axis of 370 meters and a short axis of 280 meters. There is some disagreement as to whether the total number of mounds at Watson Break should be counted as 11 or 12, because one, designated Mound L, requires further archaeological verification. It also lies outside the border of the oval formation, so firmly demarcated by the other 11 mounds and their interconnecting embankments, these latter being in the range of 20 meters wide and about 1 meter high. The plaza contained within the embankments covers an area of 9 hectares, about 22 acres, and appears to have been artificially leveled. The excavators found it to be almost completely sterile of artifacts or debris, suggesting its use as ritual space. Apparently, daily activities did not occur in the enclosure, comments Saunders. By contrast, however, daily activities suggestive of resident populations certainly did occur on the wide embankments surrounding the enclosure, particularly on the northeastern side. In a major study published in American Antiquity in 2005, Saunders reports that the initial occupation of the site took place as early as 4000 BC, and that the first occupants came to Watson Brake to fish, hunt deer, and gather plants in every season of the year. Prolonged visits probably occurred. The construction of the first minor earthworks began around 3500 BC, with mounds K and B and possibly A, followed by midden accumulations where mounds D and C and to the south I and J and E were subsequently built. This suggests that the shape of the complex was deliberately laid out by 3500 BC. Major building projects then commenced around 3350 BC. And existing earthworks may have been heightened and extended along the North Mound Row. Mound J was erected on the south side at around 3000 BC. Site occupation was concentrated along the terrace escarpment before construction began and continued after the earthworks were completed. The relative residential stability and autonomy evidenced at Watson Brake, Saunders concludes, were made possible by the diversity and abundance of resources in the local area. It seems almost superfluous to state, however, that those resources and the stability they promoted could have been exploited efficiently without the mounds. Indeed, they were exploited for the 500 years when humans were present at the site who built no mounds at all between 4000 BC and 3500 BC, and then, suddenly, mounds. Why? What could have prompted this colossal architectural enterprise? What was its purpose? I know it sounds pretty zen-like, Saunders speculated when he was asked this question in 1997, but maybe the answer is that building them was the purpose. Triangulation. Maybe. But I'm trying to envisage how the community leaders or influencers would have sold that to the population. Somehow, we want you to build these mounds because building them will be a good thing for you to do doesn't sound like a winning line to me. And when we remember that in the same period, mounds and earthworks were also being built at other scattered sites belonging to separate autonomous communities across the lower Mississippi Valley, it becomes increasingly obvious that a powerful and far-reaching social phenomenon must have been at work. After years of field research, excavations, and on-site measurements, Kenneth Sassman of the Laboratory of Southeastern Archaeology and Michael Heckenberger of the University of Florida are convinced that at least three of these sites, Watson Brake, Caney Mounds, and Frenchman's Bend, share the same basic design. The plan, we infer, from the spatial arrangement of archaic mounds, consists of a series of proportional and geometric regularities, including one, a terrace line of three or more earthen mounds oriented along an alluvial terrace escarpment. 2. Placement of the largest mound of each complex in the terrace edge group, typically in a central position. 3. Placement of the second largest mound at a distance roughly 1.4 times that between members of the terrace edge group. 4. A line connecting the largest and the second largest mound, herein referred to as the baseline, set at an angle that deviates roughly 10 degrees from a line orthogonal to, in other words, at right angles to, the terrace line. And 5, an equilateral triangle oriented to the baseline that intercepts other mounds of the complex and appears to have formed a basic unit of proportionality. I won't attempt to describe Frenchman's Bend or the several other sites that Sassman and Heckenberger believe may also fit this pattern. Watson Brake and Caney can stand for them all. Again, a long story must be cut short, since these two sites tick all the boxes listed above. But perhaps the most striking outcome of Sassmann and Heckenberger's study is the clear evidence they've produced for a shared geometrical plan involving the mounds designated A, E, I, and J at Watson Brake and mounds B, F, E, and D at Caney. In both cases, the line that Sassmann and Heckenberger call the baseline between the largest and second largest mounds, A and E at Watson Brake, B and F at Caney, forms one side of an equilateral triangle. In both cases, the lines that form the other two sides of the triangle extend through a second pair of mounds, I and J at Watson Brake, E and D at Caney, before intersecting. And in both cases, a line emanating from the baseline evenly bisects the gap between a second pair of mounds, B and K at Watson Brake, A and C at Caney. All equilateral triangles have internal angles of 60 degrees, but why, asks Norman Davis in a review of Sassmann and Heckenberger's findings, did middle archaic builders use a 60-degree triangle? Why not a 45-degree or a 65 or a 75-degree triangle? The answer to this question, he suggests, has everything to do with the sun. It is probably not a coincidence that at Watson Brake, the distance along the horizon from where the sun rises or sets on the winter solstice to where it rises or sets on the summer solstice defines an arc of 59 degrees. Their triangle was probably derived from this. The directors. As at Serpent Mound, as at Cahokia, as at Newark, as at High Bank, and as at Poverty Point, the primary concern of the designers of Watson Brake seems to have been to manifest, memorialize, and consummate the marriage of heaven and earth at key moments of the year. This notion of sky-ground communion, summarized in the old world in the hermetic dictum, as above, so below, but part of a universally distributed package of astronomical and geometrical memes, can involve the moon and the earth, specific stars or constellations and the earth, other planets and the earth, the Milky Way and the earth, and the sun and the earth. At Watson Brake, it's the sun and the earth that take center stage, as Norman Davis ably demonstrated in 2012 across 18 pages of the journal Louisiana Archaeology. The principal assertions concerning solstitial and equinoctial alignments that he makes there have stood the test of time and won the support of leading archaeoastronomers. In brief, Davis includes the 12 recognized mounds, A through L, in his survey, but he also takes note of two natural mounds, possibly modified, that in his view were intentionally left near the center of the oval in antiquity when the rest of the plaza was artificially leveled. These he designates mounds 1 and 2. Among his key findings, the most immediately striking is that no fewer than 5 separate alignments running through the site each independently and redundantly target the summer solstice sunset. Even if the alignments were not to the sun, Davis writes, the ability to establish 5 perfectly parallel, nearly equidistant sight lines across several hundred meters would be remarkable. The sight lines had to have preceded construction. Their pattern suggests a master site plan, with construction to the plan taking years or perhaps centuries to complete. Impressively, the alignments target the sun not exactly where it rises and sets today, but rather precisely where it would have risen and where it would have set in the epoch of 3400 BC, which, at the latitude of Watson Brake, was at azimuth 119 degrees for the winter solstice sunrise and at azimuth 299 degrees for the summer solstice sunset. If you are facing the setting sun on the summer solstice, then 6 months later on the winter solstice, the sun will rise in the exact opposite direction, 180 degrees around the dial of the azimuth clock. There are no alignments to the summer solstice sunrise or to the winter solstice sunset at Watson Brake, but the clear alignments to the summer solstice sunset, azimuth 299 degrees, and the winter solstice sunrise, azimuth 119 degrees identified by Davis, are as follows. From Mound A to Mound B. From Mound J to Mound 2. From Mound D to Mound L. From Mound I to the southern edge of Mound D. from Mound E to the outside edge of the double bulge on the Mound E platform. The Mound J to Mound 2 sightline, Davis adds, continues on and passes through the center of the gap between Mounds C and D. The Mound D to Mound L sightline passes through the center of the gap between Mounds I and J. The sightlines have azimuths of 119 degrees and 299 degrees. Could Watson Brake's multiple alignments to the summer solstice sunset and the winter solstice sunrise have come about by chance? It already seems vanishingly unlikely, but what settles the matter is that the site's concerns turn out to be not only with the solstices, but also with the spring and autumn equinoxes, those special times of balance around March 21st and September 21st, when night and day are of equal length, and the sun rises perfectly due east and sets perfectly due west. Davis has identified four equinoctial alignments at Watson Brake as follows: from Mound A to Mound C, from Mound 1 to Mound 2, from Mound E to Mound F, from Mound G to Mound H. In addition, several of these equinox sightlines, notably Mounds E to F and Mounds G to H, extend to other mounds and features of the earthwork in such a way, Davis notes, that their east-to-west alignment had to have preceded construction. This suggests that equinox alignments were used to engineer this site, and not only the equinox alignments. The length of the Watson Brake earthworks is defined by the alignment to the summer solstice sunset of the two ends of its principal axis, Mound L in the southeast and Mound D in the northwest. Its breadth is defined on one side by the Mound E to Mound E platform alignment, and on the other by the Mound A to Mound B alignment, both also solstitial. All in all, Davis makes a strong case that the entire design of the site is an artifact of its solstitial and equinoctial alignments. They came first, everything else followed. The question that remains unanswered, however, is why? Davis sidesteps it, stating that his purpose is only to demonstrate that solstice and equinox alignments are present at Watson Brake. There's no doubt he has succeeded in this enterprise, as his findings regarding the site's solstice alignments have subsequently been confirmed at a higher level of technical precision in a LIDAR survey by archaeoastronomer William Romaine. Building on the discoveries made by Davis, Romaine's conclusions are striking. Watson Brake incorporates sophisticated geometric designs tied to astronomical sightlines in multiple ways. As someone who has worked mostly in the field of Hopewell archaeology, I am still trying to wrap my head around the fact that all this anticipates Adena and Hopewell by thousands of years. Indeed, the significance of these findings is that Watson Brake appears to be the earliest known celestially aligned mound complex in North America. That's a big deal. The fact that it's a big deal only makes the unanswered why question more urgent, but Davis admits he's unable to think of any practical reason why the site should have been designed and engineered around solar sightlines. In fact, it must have added to the difficulty of construction. The logical conclusion, he suggests, is that using solar azimuths to design and build Watson Brake may have had more to do with cosmology, beliefs about the origin and nature of the universe, than astronomy, the scientific study of the heavens. None of the other Middle Archaic sites have yet had the benefit of the sort of thorough archaeoastronomical survey that Davis and subsequently Romaine have been able to carry out at Watson Brake. However, Davis estimates from map analysis, within a margin of error of plus or minus 2%, that the Caney Mound site has one equinox alignment and two summer and winter solstice alignments. Frenchman's Bend has one equinox alignment and one winter solstice alignment. The mystery, although the sites so far investigated show no evidence for the development of astronomical knowledge over time, is that the people who directed the construction of Watson Brake had an advanced knowledge of the solar and probably lunar cycles, and they used this knowledge to design and engineer their sites. Who were these directors, and how did they get others to build the sites, one container of Earth at a time? Reincarnations. Other questions should be asked. How were these directors able to manifest geometrical and astronomical knowledge and advanced combinations of the two more than 5,000 years ago, when no prior evidence of the existence of such abilities has been found in North America at such an early date? Set aside for a moment the issue of the organizational competence necessary to motivate and manage the workforce. The bigger problem is that the scientific skills and the knowledge required to create the earthworks just seem to appear out of nowhere, with no evolution and no build-up. One minute they're not there, the next, almost magically, they are, and then, at once, the Middle Archaic mound-building phenomenon bursts into full bloom. We know it starts earlier, but for convenience, let's take the fluorescence of Watson Brake around 3400 BC as a benchmark. What follows there and at other sites is roughly 700 years of stability, continuity, and we must assume, given the similarities, communications and connections. As noted earlier, these were all different cultures, but they all shared the same mound-building obsession and continued to express it in the same ways, until sometime around 2700 BC. That was when, for some unexplained reason, the ancient sites were all abandoned, and the whole mound-building enterprise came to an abrupt and complete halt. I'll let Joe Saunders, the acknowledged expert on the subject, take up the story of the mysterious end of Middle Archaic mound-building. New radiometric data indicate a sudden and widespread cessation of mound-building in northeast Louisiana. The clustering of the 10 youngest dates from 7 mounds at 4 sites is remarkable. The median probability for 7 of the 10 samples falls between 2884 BC and 2739 BC. Equally remarkable is that the cessation of mound construction may have lasted up to 1,000 years or until the emergence of the Poverty Point culture. To date, not one mound site dating to the late Archaic, 2700 BC to 1700 BC, has been identified in the lower Mississippi Valley. Saunders declines to speculate in any depth about the reasons for this precipitous end to the precocious early mound-building phenomenon in North America. He's open to the possibility, suggested by some, that climate change might have been involved, but states his own view that the synchronous event may be better understood as a social phenomenon. The abandonment of an ideology or change in ethos can occur simultaneously within a diverse range of environments. Also, the absence of environmental change would be consistent with the documented continuity in economy from early to late archaic periods before, during, and after mound building. Whatever the reason, the facts are not in doubt. Mound building, with all its sophisticated geometry and astronomy, stopped dead in its tracks around 2700 BC. For the next 1,000 years, not a single mound was built, and not a single earthwork was raised. There's not a hint of geometry or of monumental architecture. The only reasonable conclusion is that those skills have been utterly lost. But then, as suddenly and mysteriously as the mound-building movement had vanished, it appeared again at around 1700 BC in the spectacular and sophisticated form of Poverty Point. All the old geometrical and astronomical skills were redeployed there, and by practiced hands, as though they'd been in regular use all along. Poverty Point thrived for the next 600 or so years, only to be abandoned in its turn at around 1100 BC. Then it seems that mound building was interrupted again until relatively late in the development of the culture archaeologists call the Adena. The label Adena is in fact the name of the country estate in Ohio on which the type site was found. We have no idea what that culture called itself. Its origins can be traced back to around 1000 BC. However, no early Adena mounds exist, and those that have been dated, such as the Adena Mound type site, cluster around 200 BC, or in the case of Serpent Mound, 300 BC, but not significantly earlier. It looks very much as if there was another hiatus, perhaps not of 1,000 years, let's say 800 years, between the end of Poverty Point and the rebirth of the mound builder movement late in the Adena period. Thereafter, it grew again to full force in its Hopewell and later Mississippian manifestations, until finally being brought to an end by the European conquest. Despite the fact that different cultures were involved at different periods, every resurgence of mound building was linked to the reiteration and reimagination of the same geometrical and astronomical memes. This was not chance or coincidence. Witness, for example, the way that Lower Jackson Mound was used as the base datum from which the entire geometry of Poverty Point was calculated. Or, at a more human level, consider the case of the highly polished hematite plummet, a valuable item that was made at Poverty Point at around 1500 BC, but that some pilgrim carefully carried to the by then long abandoned and deserted site of Watson Brake and deliberately buried half a meter deep near the top of Mound E. This kind of behavior, the incorporation of ancient sites into younger ones, pilgrimage, an offering, has the feel of a religion about it. Religious institutions have proved themselves throughout history to be extremely efficient vehicles for the preservation and transmission of memes across periods of thousands of years. It's not unreasonable, therefore, to suppose that some kind of cosmic sky-ground religion lay behind the alignments to the solstices and the equinoxes at Watson Brake and at the other early sites. A religion sufficiently robust to ensure the continuous, successful transmission of a system of geometry, astronomy, and architecture over thousands of years. John Clark is in no doubt. The evidence, he says, suggests very old and widely disseminated knowledge about how to build large sites. The building lore persisted remarkably intact for so long that I think we can and must assume that it was part of special knowledge tied to ritual practice. Where did this special knowledge come from before it appeared at Watson Brake? How old is it really? And why, like the serpent that changes its skin, or the phoenix reborn from the ashes, does it possess the extraordinary ability to vanish for millennia and then to reappear, as Clark puts it, with no apparent distortions, loss of measurement accuracy, or shifts in numeration? If it was carried in religious ritual among the ancient civilizations of the Mississippi Valley, then perhaps there will be clues to its origins and its purpose in what survives of the spiritual ideas of those long-lost people.